Well, good morning and welcome, everyone.
Good morning.
It's great to see so many smiling faces out there. My name is Dan Proud. I'm the presider today. I am not the minister. Our minister will be speaking, next week, is it?
Next week.
Reverend Sandy Ingham. Prairie aspires to be an open-minded and open-hearted community. We welcome people of every ethnic and religious background, regardless of sexual orientation, color, gender, or family structure. No matter what your age or abilities or inabilities, so welcome.
May we be reminded here of our highest aspirations and inspired to bring our gifts of love and service to the altar of humanity. May we know once again that we are not isolated beings, but connected in mystery and miracle to the universe, to this community, and to each other.
Well, we have a member of our congregation is no stranger to the podium and happens to be my wife. I don't know what I have to say. Let's see, maybe something about her that you don't know. one thing that she, Robin Proud, is passionate about is reading. And so I think she has something to say about that. And please welcome Robin Proud.
Good morning.
Good morning.
With everything I was doing, I didn't put on my name tag, but here at Prairie, we have items on our name tags that indicate something about us. My husband's got music. I see Marilyn there with the dogs. We've got people that have canoes and gardens and all kinds of things, and mine has books. So it's a little different for me to be up here. Usually, I'm bringing you some of my series on the famous women we've never heard of, but this time there's something else that I really wanted to share, and this will be interactive that you'll get a chance to share something at the end. I don't remember learning how to read. Apparently my brother, who was 2 years older, came home from school and he shared with me the immortal prose, "Look, Jane, see spot, run," and I somehow picked that up. I was about four. We lived on a farm in a remote area of Pennsylvania, and the nearest library was in a town about 15 miles away. It wasn't very big, and there was no such thing at that time as interlibrary loan. So I think that the children's section was just a few bookshelves sort of the size of the one back there, which I have read through many times. We didn't have a lot of money for books, and it wasn't as easy to, there weren't a lot of places around to purchase books. I had some that belonged to my mother and even her father, which was wonderful. And I read some of those over and over, but now I've realized that a lot of times for children, even if they have many books at their disposal, they do enjoy reading the same ones again, so that was not a deprivation. However, when I was 10, we moved to the city of Philadelphia. That's a whole other story, but there, the main public library is a huge stone building, and the children's room alone was about six times as big as that whole small town library had been. I thought I was in heaven. I've always loved reading. Sometimes I've had to adapt. When I had two small children, a magazine article was about as long as I could get through without interruption. So when my kids got into school and I started working full-time in a business office, I thought it was terrific that I got to have a 15-minute break where I could just go and sit and read. I almost lost my love of reading once, and that was because I went to graduate school studying literature. It's sort of like the theory that if you catch your child smoking, you should force him to smoke a whole pack of cigarettes at once, kind of aversion therapy. Well, not only did we have to read 900-page tomes like Little Dorrit in a week, but then we had to take them apart and according to the prevailing trends, which were things like Freudianism, Marxism, structuralism. But I even bounced back from that eventually. So over the years, as I've been reading, I've also regularly heard the opinion that people who read a lot are eggheads, antisocial loners who can't cope with the real world and are trying to escape. But that wasn't my experience. I felt like I got more connected to the world through reading. For instance, some years ago, I read a novel by Marge Piercy called The Longings of Women. Now, I don't think it's one of her best books, but I still remember that there's one character who was a middle-class woman named Mary, and through a series of events, she loses her husband and her home. The description of what she has to do to get through the day in the Boston area where she lives, when she's not allowed to sit down, lie down, or wash in any public place, really stuck with me and gave me a visceral experience of homelessness that I wouldn't have gotten from articles with statistics. In the same way, I think I paid more attention to the war in Afghanistan after I read The Kite Runner. Now, this might seem shallow, but it makes sense to me. Just as you might care more about looking at the news from a certain place if you have a friend or a cousin living there. Well, I had that sense, like, oh, I know someone from there. I think that journalists actually are understanding that power, and that's why what we see in long-form journalism is more of a narrative with continuing characters and story development. Well, many other people report similar experiences. Online, a woman shared about what she said was that books saved her from racism. She grew up in a white family in the South, and her family was very sure of how racial inequality was supposed to be. But she read To Kill a Mockingbird, and then later she read James Baldwin, Toni Morrison, and other writers, and she saw that there were other views. But all this, of course, is just personal anecdotal evidence by a few people. So I was delighted to start seeing articles in the last couple of years about studies linking reading and empathy. In 2006, Keith Oatley and Raymond Marr from the University of Toronto published a study on this topic. And what they did, they assessed volunteers according to how much they read and if they read fiction or nonfiction. And they tested the participants on emotion, perception, and social cognition. So how do you do that? They had a couple of tests. One of them, they showed photos with just the eyes, and they asked the participants, what emotion is this person feeling? Is this person frightened, or joyful, or angry? They also showed video clips, and they asked about interactions of the people in the scenes. Oatley and Marr found that the more fiction people read, the better they were at perceiving emotions and interpreting social cues. But did this prove a causal link? It certainly makes sense that people who are already interested in emotions and relationships would read a lot of fiction, because that's often what it's about. So to test that, in 2009, the same two researchers took a new group of 252 adults. They measured the participants ahead of time for traits such as extroversion, agreeableness, and conscientiousness, and they assessed their social networks to see how connected they were to other people. They found a significant relation between the amount of fiction people read and their empathetic abilities. Also, they found that people who read mostly fiction, far from being loners or escapists, were actually less socially isolated than nonfiction readers. Their position was that reading fiction affects what is called theory of mind, the ability to recognize and take on the perspective of other people. Recent brain research has enabled researchers to see that there's an effect of reading. When someone reads, "He threw the ball," regions associated with arm movements are activated in the brain. When the sentence is, "He kicked the ball," regions associated with leg movements light up in the same way. So, and also reading about experiences or emotions of characters triggers those emotions in the brain. So, it does make sense. Certainly people who like to read romance feel that they get to fall in love again. And people who like to read thrillers get the adrenaline rush without having to be in danger. In 2013, two other researchers from the New School for Social Research in New York City recruited subjects for their experiment through Amazon.com. Participants ranged from 18 to 75 years old, and they were paid a small amount, $2 to $3, to read for a short period. It was under 30 minutes. Some read excerpts from literary fiction. For example, one of them was The Round House by Louise Erdrich, which is a terrific book, by the way. Others read popular fiction, such as romance or science fiction. And some read nonfiction articles, and they specifically chose them without human characters. So, for instance, How the Potato Changed the World. After reading, they took the emotion perception test, which was the eye reading test. The researchers found that those who read the literary fiction scored better than those who read popular fiction, or nonfiction, or nothing at all. And this happened even when people said they didn't particularly enjoy reading the literary fiction. In popular fiction, the emphasis is on the plot, usually. So the motives and desires of the characters are told to the reader by the author. In literary fiction, the researcher said, the incompleteness of the characters turns your mind to trying to understand the minds of others. So these results imply that people can be primed for social skills. And when this came out, it was written in the New York Times. It said, well, if you're going on a date or to an interview, perhaps you should sit down and read some Jane Austen or Louise Erdrich or some other writer. But there's still many questions. How long does that effect last? And is an analysis of faces and videos, which are visual, even a good way to test overall empathy? Does this work for children? Well, for the last question, there was a study done. Dr. Marr from the original study in Toronto led a team that studied preschool children. They found that the more fictional stories preschoolers heard and the more fictional movies they saw, the better they did on tests of children's theory of mind. Now, the way they did that test is they'd have a puppet and say, oh, this puppet really loves broccoli. It likes broccoli better than cookies. Then as they're playing, they would ask which snack the puppet should have. And the fact that the child could understand that the puppet might like something different from what the child would pick shows that they were able to understand theory of mind. Well, the children who watched TV did not have the same results, possibly because TV shows tend to be simpler and prevent fewer opportunities to take on another point of view. Dr. Oatley has written, fiction is the original virtual reality. Fiction is about possible selves in possible worlds. It's a bit ironic that we're discovering the importance of fiction for children at a time when education reforms are emphasizing nonfiction. My understanding is that in some places classes were urged to read practical materials like user manuals. Now, while we need to know those things, what could really be more practical than learning to understand and care about other people? So there was a lot of press in the last few years about this whole endeavor. An article from the Boston Globe from April 2012 states, research shows that fiction does mold us. The more deeply we are cast under a story's spell, the more potent its influence. In fact, fiction seems to be more effective at changing beliefs than nonfiction, which is designed to persuade through argument and evidence. Studies show that when we read nonfiction, we read with our shields up. But when we are absorbed in a story, we drop our intellectual guard. We are moved emotionally, and that seems to make us rubbery and easy to shape. Fiction enhances our ability to understand other people. It promotes a deep morality that cuts across religious and political creeds. So that was the writer from the Boston Globe. This isn't a totally new concept. Plato wanted to ban novels from his Republic because he thought they had too much influence over citizens. Jane Austen, 300 years ago, has a character say in Northanger Abbey, which is largely about books, only a novel, only some work in which the greatest powers of the mind are displayed, in which the most thorough knowledge of human nature, the happiest delineation of its varieties, the liveliest effusions of wit and humor are conveyed to the world in the best chosen language. Stories can change our views. Studies show that when we watch a TV show or read a book that treats gay families positively, our own views are likely to move in that direction. Uncle Tom's Cabin famously stirred up anti-slavery sentiment. However, it could work both ways. When we talk about becoming rubbery, Gone with the Wind contains a justification for the Ku Klux Klan, and many people claim their philosophy comes from the novels of Ayn Rand. Now, that's one author I have not read, but my impression is that empathy is not one of her values. And why does empathy matter so much? So, and why am I talking about this at all? I have heard from some people who feel that when we have our book sharing Sundays, that that's not really an appropriate topic for a Sunday morning because it's really not spiritual. Now, some of us have different versions of what is spiritual to us, but what I want to specifically talk about is why this connects to what I believe. When we had a little panel here about what I believe, I called myself a humanist. And as such, I feel the highest value is empathy. The first UU principle, the worth and dignity of every individual, certainly stems from that. But I think that this undergirds all of our principles. When we talk about encouraging each other in spiritual growth, about compassion, about the rights of the individuals, all of those exist within empathy. Even the seventh principle about the interdependent web of which we are a part is a larger field of empathy. And in my opinion, just about every evil stems from a lack of empathy. If we have empathy, we don't bully people, we don't blame them for their misfortunes, and we certainly don't torture them. I personally think that torture is about the greatest failure of empathy there is, even more than killing. And as such, it's one of the few things that I just can't read about in fiction. I have to sort of skip over sometimes. Some people have things where they can't read about an animal being hurt, for instance, or children in peril, and I just have a lot of trouble with deliberate cruelty. And we see it in other places. Last night, some of us went to see the movie Selma. Well, the differentiation between races can only happen when you make that person other than you and you are not able to put yourself in their place. As I was preparing this talk, I continued to see relevant information. A New York Times article on December 11th showed that gay political canvassers who had respectful face-to-face discussions with voters shifted the views of voters on gay marriage by about 20% and in a lasting way, and also often affected other people in that household. This didn't happen when the canvassers were straight people or when canvassers were talking about non-personal issues like recycling. Although Peter would say that's a spiritual issue as well. But what moved people was really someone telling his or her own story. That's why this was so effective, was that people were able to come around and say, this is our story and this is who we are. And that's what got people to shift their opinions. And just a couple Sundays ago, the Times had an essay called How Reading Transforms Us. It was co-authored by Dr. Keith Oatley, who was one of the leaders of the original study that I cited. And its focus was on how reading not only gets us to think about and understand other people better, but also to think about and understand ourselves. So that's a whole other area. Now we do have some caveats. These studies were done with relatively small samples. And even though the researchers controlled for personality traits, if the subjects were taken from university students, which is often the case, or even shoppers on Amazon, they may not have totally reflected the general population. And I also owe to Tom Lovett, who I don't think is here today, the acknowledgement that biography can certainly serve the same purpose. Biography is telling us a person's story with all its complications, or history, well written, for instance, by Doris Kearns Goodwin, can also give us a chance to get into the world of another person, another time and place. We might have a simple view of Lincoln that we learned in school, and when we read her biography, there is so much more, and it's not all consistent, just like the rest of us. So it is not that only reading fiction is what causes this, but it has to do with the way that it's written. And none of this is to disparage or discourage the reading of quality nonfiction. We definitely need quality information. We need opinions and science. And after all, that's what I'm presenting today, is from the world of nonfiction. So I'll close this section with another anecdote of a reader's experience that was shared in an online book group. I'm quite addicted to the site Goodreads. I used to recommend it wholeheartedly. It has been acquired by Amazon a few years ago, so I'm not sure I recommend it quite as wholeheartedly, but I do enjoy a lot of things on there. I belong to one group where we are reading all the books of Dickens in the order they were written, and we're reading them kind of the way they came out, 40 or 50 pages at a time, so that it doesn't take over your whole life. However, this is an endeavor of many years. But the wonderful thing about this group is that we have people around the world doing this. We have a retired professor of English in England who will post something with a picture of the area that's in the book. And we have young people who have never read this before and people who come from different backgrounds. So it's really been delightful. And I'll be giving a presentation on Dickens as a result of that sometime this year. And then in some other book groups online, I've just heard some wonderful stories. And this one, was a man who was in his 50s or 60s, and he had a long career in engineering in both military and civilian life. He was very accomplished, highly intelligent. He read a lot of science, technology, and other nonfiction works, but he couldn't understand how anyone could waste their time reading silly, made-up stories. Then one day, he was in a summer cottage with nothing to read. His college-age daughter had left behind a copy of Emma by Jane Austen, so he started to read it. At first, it was challenging for him to get used to this different type of writing. But as he got into it, he was amazed at how absorbing it was and how much he cared about the characters and what happened to them. He had no idea that reading could engage the emotions. And he himself posted this where he said when he got to the end, he was laughing, crying, and jumping around the room. He discovered he was romantic at heart. He went on to read everything by Jane Austen and anyone like her. And I kind of envy him this discovery. It's a bit like The Wizard of Oz, where she goes from the black and white and all this color is there. And if a new book were suddenly discovered by Jane Austen today and I read it, I would love that, but I would have some idea how it was going to turn out. He really had no idea how this was going to turn out, so this was so exciting. Now, did this change his life in other ways? He didn't say that, but I have to think that being in touch with his emotions in this way through novels had to rub off on his ability to express himself with his family and friends. And just the fact that he shared this story online with great gusto, and he's proudly a regular reviewer now of historical romances, shows a whole new side of his character. So now, we're going to get to a very fun part of the program. I'd like to invite you to share with us a book that changed your life. It doesn't have to be fiction, although from what we've seen, I think that's more likely. But I'll give you a couple of brief examples. The summer before I went to college, I read War and Peace. I subsequently changed my course schedule in order to study Russian because I was so fascinated by this book. Now, this would be a better story if I had traveled to Russia or married a Russian or something like that, but none of that happened. Maybe another example, a little roundabout, is I read The Mists of Avalon around 1990, and that's a story about King Arthur told from the point of view of all the women in the book. I thought it was terrific, but what influenced me even more was there was an afterword where she mentioned that modern groups had reintroduced some of these pagan goddess traditions. That was totally new to me. I was intrigued, and researching that further actually led me to one of the first talks I gave at the Unitarian Church that I belonged to at that time. So you may have something that's even more striking about how a book engaged you. A wonderful book that I haven't mentioned is a book of quotations by women that my husband gave me many years ago, and I use all the time when I do my talks here. This is from Virginia Woolf. When the day of judgment dawns, and the great conquerors and lawyers and statesmen come to receive their rewards, their crowns, their laurels, their names carved indelibly upon imperishable marble, the Almighty will turn to Peter and will say, not without a certain envy, when he sees us coming with our books under our arms, look, these need no reward. We have nothing to give them here. They have loved reading.
So please greet your neighbor and stay afterwards for coffee. And I believe we have some baked goods to buy. Thank you for coming.